Okay, we're going to begin here on the bottom of Pei Ted Amud Bet by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Shnei Gitin Ushtei Ketubot. A woman who shows up with two bills of divorce, as well as two Ketubot, Govah Shtei Ketubot. Then she's entitled to two Ketubot. Rashi qualifies this and explains that's only if the first Ketubah is dated before the first Get, and the second Ketubah is dated before the second Get, post the first. So that way it's clear what happened here was that he was married to her twice, and in each instance he granted her a ketubah. So she's collecting on both of those ketubot, which she's entitled to. On the other hand, shtei ketubot v'get echad, she has two ketubot and one bill of divorce, or ketubah u'shnei gitin, one ketubah and two bills of divorce, o ketubah v'get umita, or she has a ketubah, a bill of divorce, and then now her husband passed away. Eino gova ela ketubah achat. In that instance, she's only entitled to one ketubah. Shemegaresh et ishto vehechzira, because the person who divorces his wife and then takes her back, almanat ketubah rishona machzira. He's allowed to return her premised on the first ketubah, assuming that she has yet to be paid out on the first ketubah from the divorce. He can rely on that ketubah when he takes her back. And therefore, there's a possibility here that this woman has two bills of divorce, or has a bill of divorce, and her husband's passing away, and she's only entitled to one ketubah, because she got divorced and remarried. And because of that, we assume that he did it premised on the first ketubah, and that's why she's showing up here with a deficit of documents some way, not because she's entitled to another ketubah, but because when he remarried her, he utilized the first ketubah. Now this was mentioned in the Mishnah earlier with regards to the Yavam and the Yavama, that when he takes her back, it's Amanat Ketubah Rishona. Again, it's clear that that's only when he hasn't paid it out yet. If he's already paid out the ketubah, then the Shibud is gone and the ketubah has already been utilized. You need to then write a separate or a new ketubah in that case. But if that was true, she wouldn't be coming here with a claim for two ketubot. So the only way that it happens is if she has yet to be paid out, and then he remarries her, he can't rely on that first ketubah in order to do it. Now, the case with shtei ketubot and get achat, where seemingly she should be entitled to two ketubot, that's in a case where both of them are dated prior to the get. So the bill of divorce only triggers one of the ketubot, and not two of the ketubot, which the Gemara will explain why that is, but it's got to be a case where they both predate the get. Now, the Gemara says here, iboi bahai gavyo, Iboi Bahai Gavyo. Seemingly here, where she has two ketubot, if she so chooses, she can go ahead and collect with either ketubah. In the case where she has two ketubot that predate the get, then she has the bill of divorce and she wants to collect, seemingly she's led or entitled to use either one of the ketubot. Lema, Tevi Tiyuvta, the Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel. That should be problematic. That should undermine the position of Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel, who we saw back on Daf Mem Dalet. Damar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel, Shnei Shtarot, O Yotzim Bezeh Achar Zeh. If you have two documents that document the same event, whether it's a marriage, whether it is a loan, whether it is a sale transaction, if you have two documents that say the exact same thing, just one is dated prior to the other, Bitel Sheni Et HaRishon. The second one nullifies the first one. The only reason to write the second one is because there was something wrong with the first one. And therefore, the second one supplants the first one. And that's in any of these cases. La vitmar la. Didn't we qualify that back on Mem Dalet? Amar al papa, umode Rav Nachman, di osif be dikla lo tosefet katve. If the second document has some additional item in it, then that is a sufficient reason to write the second document. So if we have something that would explain the writing of the second document, not just an exact replica of the first document, then we would agree that there's a reason for the second document because he wanted to add in additional information in the second document. So in a case where it's identical, then the second document governs. In a case where the second document adds information, then you have a choice, which is that you can utilize the first document and collect on it based on the first date, or you can utilize the second document, collect the entire amount in the second document, which is going to be larger than the first document, but then you have to go by the second date, the date on the second document. So it's an option of power of your shibud, when did your lien begin, versus the size of the payout that we have from this document. So you have to make a choice in that case. You would not be able to collect on both of them. Hachanami, so too in our case, Osifla. In our case as well, in the Mishnah, when she has stake to both and get achat, they both predate the get. In that instance, the second tuba adds some information, adds some value that wasn't there in the first tuba. That's why there's a second one. So that's why it doesn't supplant the first tuba. On the other hand, you have to make a choice. Do you want to collect with the better lien, or do you want to collect with the larger amount? Tana banan. Hotzia get uktuba umita. In a case where she pulls out a bill of divorce, a ktuba, and her husband passed away. Im get kodem lik tuba. If the bill of divorce precedes the ktuba, kovash tek tubot. Then she's entitled to two ktubot. It's clear that since the tuba is dated after the get, that it wasn't for the first marriage. So he wrote her a second tuba. That means she's entitled to a tuba from the first time they were married and the bill of divorce. Now she's entitled to a second tuba from the time that he remarried her plus the mita that he passed away. Tuba kodemet leget. On the other hand, if the tuba is dated before the bill of divorce, eno gova leg tuba achat. Then she's only entitled to one tuba. Because then we assume, shemegareshet tishto v'echzira, was a case where he divorced his wife, and then returned her. Amanat ktuba rishona echzira. He brought her back based on the first ktuba. So you have a get that is after a ktuba. So that says that that's one unit, and she would get paid out for that ktuba. But now she says, listen, I'm married to him, and he just passed away. I should be entitled to a second ktuba. We say no, that he utilized that first ktuba in order to maintain the second marriage, and therefore she's only entitled to one ktuba. Right, next Mishnah, Katan Shisio Aviv. A Katan was married off by his father. Ktubata Kayemet. Her Ktuba stays in force. Shamanat Kain Kaima. Because when he maintains the marriage after he becomes a Gadol, the reason that he did that, or what it's premised on, is the original Ktuba that he granted her. So even though the Ktuba that he granted her while he was a Katan is meaningless, or really has no Tokef, because he was a Katan, nevertheless, if they remain married after he becomes of age, then the ktuba remains in force. Ger shenit gaira ishto imo. Similar, a convert who has his wife convert with him. Ktubata kayemet. Her ktuba is maintained. Shamanat kein kaima. Because for that reason, he continues the marriage. So you do not have to write a new ktuba here. Even though the original ktuba, as we say, is chaspa ba'alma, is just a piece of paper, is not really worth anything because it was given at a time that it had no force. It could not be effective. Nevertheless, since they maintained the marriage afterwards, we say that it's premised on that original ktuba. Amar Rabuna, lo shanu ela mana matayim. The only thing that's in force from this document is the core ktuba. The core ktuba, which is the woman's entitled to 100 for an almana or 200 for a b'dula. Aval tosefet ela. The additional amounts that were added in to the ktuba, there she has no entitlement to them for exactly this reason. It's a chaspa v'alma. The shtar itself has no power, is not effective in any way because it was written at a time that it couldn't have gone into force. So yes, when we continue the marriage, we continue the marriage with the ktuba, but we continue with the core ktuba, the things that are in every woman or every marriage is entitled to. The tosefta ktuba, you're right, that shtar wasn't worth anything, so you can't do anything with it. Rabbi Yehuda Amar, afilu tosefet yeshla. So Rabbi Yehuda says, even the extra stuff that was in ktuba, she's entitled to. So now the Gemara asks about that. Meitav, is that really true? Chidshu, notelet, mashi chidshu. Chidshu, in, lo chidshu, lo. So in a case where a katan came of age, or a ger converted, if they added something onto the original ktuba, in that they did something that added or did something different about the ktuba, so there's a chidush in the ktuba, that means that they revalidated it, they made it effective again, the ktuba, at a time when it could go effective, then it's fine. But if they did nothing new to the ktuba, then it's not in force. So that supports the position of Rav Huna, and is a difficulty for the position of Rav Yehuda. So where it says, Eima af mashichidshu, that when they add this additional item in there, not only is the original in force, but even the additional item is in force. So they say, not just the chidush, but af, the chidush is in force. It says, v'halo toni hachi. Don't we have a brayta that seemingly indicates otherwise, which is, chidshu, Notelet mashechitshu. That if they put something new into the ketubah, into the document, then she gets what they did, what they added in. Lo chitshu. If they did nothing new in the document, tula gova matayim, ve'almana maneh. A tula gets her 200, the almana gets her 100. Tiyufta de Rabbi Yehuda. That's a very strong indication against Rabbi Yehuda, because it's clear here, when they didn't do anything chidush, that all that she's entitled to is the core tuba, which is the 100 and 200. The tosefet does not exist at all. Rabbi Yehuda matnitin ataite. Rabbi Yehuda was misled by our Mishnah. Husavar ktubata kayemet akula miltokoi. When our Mishnah says that the ktuba is in force, he thought that's literally what it means. It's in force. Everything in the ktuba is in force. Velohi, that's not what it meant. Aikar ktuba koi. It's going on the core component of the ktuba, which is the 100 and the 200. So now what David's asking, Tosafot asks, and he says, I don't understand this gemara here. If the document is in force, then she should be entitled to everything. If the document is not in force, because it's chaspa ba'alma, it's like a piece or shard of pottery, and it's not worth anything because it was put into effect at a time that it couldn't go into effect, then it's not worth anything. So then what was the point of the document here at all? Because this woman's entitled to a ketubah, whether or not she has a ketubah. We learned that earlier in the Masechta. It's a tnai beitin. Tnai beitin is that a woman gets 100 if she is an almana, 200 if she's a ptula, whether or not she has a document or a ketubah at all. So Tosafot says, what do I need the Mishnah to tell me, almanat kain, that when he maintains the relationship, it's on the premise of the original ketubah? Even if it wasn't on the premise of the original ketubah, she's entitled to a ketubah, mitznai beitin. So then what does that do for you? What do you need this Mishnah at all? What do you need that document at all for? She has the ikar ketubah without this document whatsoever. So Tosafot answers, v'yesh lomar, tashmin heikha denasa betula. He married her as a betula. So when he married her as a betula, she was entitled to 200. Then we come to the point where the katan becomes a gadol, the ger becomes a Jew. In that instance, now we're going to reaffirm the marriage at that point. She is no longer a betula, she's a beula at this point. So Tosafot claims that had we just said that it was a tnai beitin, she would only be entitled to a ketubah ben almana. Because the ketubah almana, or ketubah be'ula, because at the time that the tnai beitin kicks in, she is a be'ula. What the continuation, or what the Mishnah allows us to do is say that they are staying married, premised on the original ketubah, which means she's still entitled to the 200, not just to the 100. So that's the chiddush that Tosafot says in this Mishnah, that the continuation is just stating that the original document entitles her to the 200. Not that the document itself has any power here, because it's a tnai beitin. But which tnai beitin is invoked? The tnai beitin that is invoked over here is the 200, because it's premised on the original ketubah, which said that she was a bitula. So that's what the original ketubah helps you with, to determine which level of payout she gets in terms of ikar ketubah. But in terms of her ability to gave mimishabde, Tosafot says, no way. She can't collect from property in terms of her lien. Her lien does not exist from that original document. It's not a document that carries weight. And therefore, her entitlement is really from the moment of the marriage going effective, which is when he becomes a gadol or the ger converts. And so therefore, she has no lien from the original document. There are others who disagree and say that she does have a lien. It just starts from the time that the marriage goes into effect, meaning from the second date when he becomes a gadol or the ger converts, she does have a lien on the property. Tosafot seems to indicate she has no lien whatsoever. Everybody seemingly agrees that the first document's invalid in terms of the lien, which is a question at this time of the marriage going effective now when he becomes a gadol. Is there a new lien then? And then the Meiri says yes, the Tosafot says no, that there is no lien whatsoever. In addition, it's interesting that Rambam in this instance says that she's only entitled to a tubat almana, that she's only entitled to 100, not to the 200. So in that case, you don't have the Chiddush of Tosafot anymore. The whole Chiddush of Tosafot is that she's deemed to be a ptula, even though now she's an almana. But the Rambam believes that Ger Shenit Gayer, with his wife with him, she's only entitled to a ketubat almana. So then what's the Chiddush that it's premise, Shamanat Kein Kaima, that it's connected to the original ketubah? So many of the Rishonim believe here that you would have thought that she might not have any entitlement to ketubah over here, because the Chachamim didn't institute the Tanai Beit Din in a case like this, where there's an existing ketubah that they think they're relying on. The Tanai Beit Din doesn't necessarily kick in because they're still relying on this original ketubah, and that's what's the determining factor. But for the Rambam, that means that she only gets a ketubah Amanah, not a ketubah Bitulah. Some of those one explained in the Rambam Shita that the difference is whether they had Bia or not. So that if they never have Bia after the time that he becomes a Gadol, or after the Gerish Nitgayer, then in that case she would not be entitled to a ketubah. Because the Mishnah says it's Amanat Kain, it's premised on the original ketubah. But that assumes that they establish a marriage Midoraita, or a Kiddushin Midoraita. So because of that, you have to have Bia. Without that Bia, there would be no ketubah. Once they have Bia, that's what it's premised on, the original ketubah. So that might be the Chiddush of the Rambam. So yes, she's not entitled to a ketubat bitulah. She's entitled to ketubat amanah. But she's only entitled to ketubah if they have Bia. And that's if they reestablish the marriage. Now, that does present some issues, because Bia, we know, only performs erusin, not necessarily nisuin. So in that case, you'd be lacking in nisuin, and that's why maybe the Tanai Beit Din doesn't kick in, that she should get a ketubah, and that's why you have to rely on the original ketubah, and that might be what the Rambam is telling us in this case. Now, the Tosafot read has a very controversial solution that would help out with this question vis-a-vis the Rambam, but his position is very controversial, as he himself acknowledges. It's at the bottom of Pei Tet Amud Bet. He says, Gersh Nitgayer Ishto Imo Kagon Oved Kochavim Shenasa Bat Yisrael. That is a case where the Gersh Nitgayer here is not a case where they are both Gerim, but rather, there's an Oved Kochavim that married a Jewish woman. And then, Katav Laktuba. At that point, he wrote her Ktuba while he was still a Goy. And then afterwards, he's Nidgayer. Ve'kaimo. And he kept her around. Ktubata Kayemet. Then the Ktuba stays in force. Now, this is the problem, which he acknowledges, and really, according to most, is why this is not true. Even though everything that the Goy wrote her when he was still a Goy is meaningless, because there's no ketubah in such a marriage. Shemanat Kein Kaima. Nevertheless, because when he converted and kept her on afterwards, that is the premise of their marriage, that ketubah stays in force. But had he never written her a ketubah when they were married and he wasn't Jewish, Achshav Shenitgayeru Mikaima, if he converted now and keeps her around, she only gets a maneh like a bi'ula. So that would support that Rambam's position, which is that when they convert, they only get a ketubat maneh. But the Reed says that's qualified by the fact that he didn't write an earlier ketubah. But had they written an earlier ketubah while he was a goy and she was Jewish, it was a intermarriage, but he had written a ketubah that was meaningless. Nevertheless, if he converts afterwards, that ketubah stays in force, and seemingly she will get a ketubah like a bi'ula. She'll keep her 200. On the other hand, if they had nothing between them, and then he converts and they stay married, she'll only get a maneh. The dav gai minasa bat Yisrael. That's only true when he marries a Jewish woman while he's a goy. She bat ktubah, because a ktubah is relevant to her, even though it's not relevant in their marriage. Aminan ktubata kayemet. Then we say the ktubah is still in force, shemanat kein kaima, because on that condition, he kept her as a wife. Aval minasa ovedet kochavim bigeyuto. If it was a goy married to a goya, and then they both converted, v'katav la ketubah, and he writes her ketubah while they still are not Jewish, v'in nit gayerahu shnehem, and then they both convert, ain la ketubah lamaneh, then she only gets 100, she ain't ketubah l'oved kochavim. She has no relevance to a ketubah, and therefore what they wrote before was meaningless. V'chol ha-mashakatav la b'giyuto, hakol hu batel. Everything that he wrote at that time is null and void. So that's a huge chiddush of the Tosafot Reed that we're talking about here, an intermarriage. And the ketubah has some sort of force because she's a Jewish woman. But had they both not been Jewish and then they continued the marriage afterwards, that original ketubah would be meaningless. Again, it's against all the other Rishonim who explained the Mishnah like we did before. All right, with that we finish the perek. Hadron Alach of Kotev Lishto. And now we begin the 10th perek. Misha Yan Nasui Shtei Nashim Umeit. He's married to two women and then he passes away. Harishona Kodemet Lishniya. The first one goes before the second one. Yosheh Rishona Kunmin Liyosheh Shniya. And the inheritors of the first have rights over the inheritors of the second. What this is saying is that whoever has the first lien here has the first entitlement. So the woman who got married to him first, her Shtar Ketubah is dated first. So she has the first right or the first claim over here. the second one who married later, she has the second lien, only second claim. Obviously, we're talking about a case where there's not sufficient property to pay out both of them. If there is sufficient property to pay out both of them, that doesn't make a difference which one's kodemet. They're both going to get paid out over here. So what we're talking about is a case where there isn't sufficient assets. Then the one who has the earlier dated shtar is the one with the right to collect. And that would be the Isha Rishona. Nasata Rishona Umeita. He marries the first wife, and she passes away. Nasa Shnia, he marries the second wife, Umeitu. And then he dies. Shnia V'yorshea Kodmim V'yorshea Rishona. The second wife and her inheritors go first before the inheritors of the first one. Because if you remember all the dinim that we've learned until now, when the wife passes away, her husband inherits her. So in the case of a claim, they have no real claim against the estate except for Tubat Benin Dichrin, which is that her male children have a right in the Yerusha to take her Ktubah or give precedence to their being paid out on her Ktubah. But that's no real entitlement in a Torah. That's a Tnai that is put into the Ktubah. On the other hand, the second woman who it now survived her husband, she is entitled to a Ktubah payout, Midoraita, if you want to call it, but she's a Balat Chov. She is a creditor now against the estate, and she has real rights of collection. So therefore, the Shnia V'yorshea Kodmin, they go first. She has the first claim of the first right here, because her right is a full force creditor right, maybe even do raita, and therefore she can collect over here, even prior to anybody getting Yerusha. Now, if there's leftover, we can talk about what we do with the leftovers. But in terms of the first right of collection, she is the one, because she's entitled to her ktubah, because she survived her husband. That's the right of a woman to collect her ktubah. Now, the Gemara is middayek over here. Midiktani arishona kodemet lishnia. The fact that our Mishnah says that the proper way to conduct oneself is that the woman who's married first gets the property, and the second one will lose out because she has the later lien. Velotani harishona yeshla vishnia inla. But it does not make a definitive statement, which is that the first wife gets and the second wife doesn't get. Michlal, from that you can infer. Did kadmashnia vitafsa. If the second woman comes and grabs whatever the asset is, lo mafkina mina, we do not extract it from her. She has a real right as a creditor here. They're both holding to both. They're both creditors here. Just that one of them has an earlier lien than the second one. So if the one with the later lien comes and grabs the property, from our Mishnah, it sounds like we would not extract that from her. We would not remove it for her in favor of the first. Because it says kodemet, which means the chatchilo, that's the way it should be. But it doesn't say the first one has, the second one doesn't, making a definitive statement. And that, from that, we are inferring that if the second one grabbed, she would get it. Shema mina, from this you would conclude, balchov me'uchar, if you have a creditor who has a later dated loan, shekodom v'gava, that went ahead and grabbed whatever was there first, mashigava gava, whatever he takes, and that's it. Right, so it's an interesting dynamic over here. Tosafot already, you can see it's a large Tosafot here, raises the issue, which is, let's just think about the scenario in which the property was already purchased. When you have the husband sold out all of his property. If the husband sells all of his property, it's clear here that whoever has the first lien is the one who has the right to take it away from the lekuchot. I mean, the person with the earlier lien has the right. The one with the later lien does not have the right to come and collect it. And that's whether it's with the husband, in case of a Baal Chov, the creditors. The same thing is true. It's very clear that what your date is on the document matters. And if you're first, you're first in line, and you can grab it from the lekuchot. So why do we say that the party with the first lien has rights against purchasers, but the party with the first lien doesn't have rights against the person with a later lien? Why is that second document no better than a lekuach? Why, if somebody went and bought the property after you have a first lien, you can go grab it back from them. So same thing over here. The person with the second lien, you should be able to go in and take it back because you have the first lien. Why do we not say that over here? What type of power is granted over here? So the Rishonim deal with this, and that's what Tosfot says. Tema, masvarehizu. What type of logic is it? Delohei balchov elokalokeach. Just let the second creditor be like a purchaser of the property. Timilokeach kufei katari balchov rishon. The earlier creditor can take it away from a buyer. So then say the same thing over here, that the later creditor, when he grabs the property, he's like a buyer, and you should be able to go in and take it away. Teretz Rashbam, de balchov meuchar adif milokeach. Says that the latter creditor is better than a purchaser. Shalotin ol delet bifnei lavin. Because for the second creditor, there's still an idea of liquidity in the market, which is that we want creditors to get repaid. They're only going to extend loans when they think they're going to get repaid. If they fear not getting repaid, they're not going to extend loans. V'chein l'ktubat isha mishum chinah. And by ktubat isha, there's also a reason for this, because of chein. V'chein teima ima shegava gava ikanila delet mibalchov harishon. Wait a minute. So now, yeah, you solved the problem in terms of the second creditor getting a collection, so he'll lend money. What about the first creditor? For him, you're locking down liquidity in the market because he's going to think, if somebody comes and grabs the property, I'm going to lose out. Lohi. Hovi acholik dom. Because he knows that if he just gets the property first, lo yimna milabot. But then he won't stop from lending money. And if it's just a matter of who gets to the property first, nobody's going to not lend because of that. So even though in these cases the first creditor will lose, when he's lending money, he's not going to think, I'm going to lose because the second creditor is going to come along. Aval imish gava lo gava. If you say that once they grab it, ikanila delech mafsid bachov mukhar the gamre. In a case where if we said that the second creditor, when he grabbed the property, didn't get to keep it, and we give it back to the first party, then you really have a loss. Because in that case, the second creditor will never get paid. So then you really have nila del bifnei lavin. Anybody puts a second mortgage on the property, then that creditor is always going to be in a position where they're really questionable whether they're going to get paid out or get paid back. When you have the first lien or the first mortgage on the property, that creditor, even when the case where we say if the second creditor grabbed it, he doesn't get it, but in most circumstances, he's going to be the first in line, and he's going to be the one that gets paid out. This is one position in the Gemara. We're going to see in a second that the Gemara has an alternate position, which it doesn't work. But in this case, Tosfot wants to understand the logic behind why would you ever allow something like this, where creditors are in line, and the creditor's rights are then subverted to the fact that this second creditor grabbed the property. Why would you ever let something like that happen? The answer being that why do we grant rights to a creditor over here in terms of their ability to collect from the kuchot, people who buy the property, is because we want people to lend money. We want to keep the market liquid. If we say that as soon as the guy sells all his property, nobody can get access to it, nobody's going to lend money. Because what they're afraid of is you lend the money, the guy sells all his property, and the creditors are out. So we granted them rights to collect from buyers. But if it's two creditors competing over there, we're not going to say that the liquidity in the market's locked up, because in general, at least one creditor is getting paid out. And the first creditor normally would get paid out in that case, so he's not fearful of this case. Now, you're right. The rights were in some way abrogated because the second creditor came after him and he should have been okay. But that's a unique part of the din here. The other reason might be that Lekuchot did something wrong. When they purchased the property after there was a lien or a creditor on the property, they did something wrong because they knew they were buying property that was encumbered to those loans. On the other hand, when it comes to the second creditor, he didn't do anything wrong. He just assumes there was sufficient property to pay out both, which there was at that time. And so now when there's only one asset left, then he's going to go after that asset to get his payment. The Ramban, on the other hand, views that the machlokit, we're going to see again that there's another side to this statement here, which is that somebody believes that you can't keep it. That has to do whether shibud is d'oraita or shibud is d'rabanan. The lien that is extended to a creditor, is that lien something min haTorah? If that's the case, then creditor order matters. And therefore, if the first creditor comes, he can take it away from the second creditor. On the other hand, if the shibud is only d'rabanan, is only rabbinic in nature, it was put in place to keep liquidity in the market, then you can talk about the logic that Tosafot introduced over here, which is that Rabbanan tried to keep liquidity in the market. But in cases where one of the creditors at least gets paid out, then we're not going to say go take it away from the second creditor, because all they did, they're abonon anyway, just to keep liquidity in the market. Now the Gemara says, le'olam emelacha. Here's the other alternative. Mashgava lo gava. Disagree? No. That the second creditor has to cough it up and give it back to the first creditor. He has a second mortgage, a second lien, and he doesn't have rights in front of the first creditor. Also, the second wife would not have rights in front of the first wife. So then, why did the Mishnah use the Lashon Kodemet? Legamrei Ketani. That's what it means. Kodemet means completely. Doesn't just mean precedence. It means totally and completely the first one gets it. How do I know that? Ketetan. I have another Mishnah that uses the same Lashon. Ben Kodem Labat. The son goes before the daughter in terms of inheritance. Over there, the Kodem doesn't mean that the son gets it before the daughter as long as she didn't grab it. But if she grabbed it, she gets it first. Nobody would ever say that. The ben gets before the daughter, always. Even if she took it, he gets it first. So same thing over here. The word kodemet over here means completely and entirely, not just lechatchila. Right. That's right. Yigadam, right? Medeloktani. Some suggest the fact that our mission doesn't explicitly state in kadmashniya vitafsa in motziyan miyada. That since the mission doesn't explicitly state the rights of the second woman, if she grabs it, that we don't take it back from her. From that, we would conclude that if the second one came and grabbed it, that we wouldn't get it. Now, Tosafot asks over here, okay, well, what do you mean? It didn't write it this way, it didn't write it that way. Why do you think that one is better than the other? Doesn't write that she has to cough it up. Doesn't write that she gets to keep it. Why are you assuming that the deficit of the Mishnah in writing, that if she took it, she gets to keep it, why is that a reason to believe that the Mishnah doesn't mean that? You could have argued just the opposite way around. The Tosafot says that that's the bigger chiddush over here. You wouldn't want, that's the bigger chiddush is to say that she gets to keep it in this case. So if you want to have a chiddush like that, you got to state it explicitly in the Mishnah. In the other case, that it goes back to the first party, that's what we would have thought without the Mishnah. So the fact is that the Mishnah didn't write this, which would have been a chiddush, then we assume that it's just not true. And therefore, shvamina, balchov mukhar shekadam begava, if you have a later creditor that comes and grabs first, mashagava, lo gava, then he doesn't get to keep it. So here you have the two different positions. It's a machloket tanaim, actually, as to whether a later creditor that grabs, it's a machloket later on in the Masechta, on Daf Tzadidalid, we have this machloket about second creditor rights. If he goes first and grabs it, whether they get to keep it or not. Gemara here wants to prove from our Mishnah as to one or two opinions. Again, the Gemara says that the Mishnah is not definitive. We can't use our Mishnah to define. You can read it one way, you can read it the other way, and you can prove both positions based on the Mishnah, and therefore our Mishnah is not a machria. But here again, Tosafot and the Ramban are all asking this question of why would you ever think that a second creditor should have rights like this, and that's what we explained before. Mara says, no, maybe whatever the second creditor takes, they get, or the second woman who grabs here gets. I need the Tana Shnia v'yorshea kodmin. Because in the second half of the Mishnah, it says that the second woman and her inheritors go before the first one. Tana Nami Rishona Kodemet Lishnia. Therefore, in the first half of the Mishnah, it says that the Rishona goes before the second one. Not to come to teach you that that's a definitive statement. It means Lechatchila and not completely. And that's why it didn't write Im Kadma V'Tasva in Motzin. And that's why I didn't add in that language, because it assumed that the word kodemet here only meant lichatchila, and it wrote it in this manner because of the second half of the Mishnah, where the Lishna of kodmin is meaningful. Because over there, they go first, and that's what's meaningful, is that she's first. The shnia there literally means kodmin. Absolutely kodmin. The second one has no rights. The first one has no rights. The second one is a creditor because she gets her ktubah. The first one has no rights whatsoever. So there in the second half of the Mishnah, kodmin means literally she gets it and the other one has no rights. In the first half of the Mishnah, they use the same lashon to keep parallel structure, but not because the word kodemin means absolute, but rather kodem means lechatchila. The Gemara says, even if you believe the word kodem means absolute, in the first half of the Mishnah, you could argue that it doesn't mean absolute. It was only utilized because of the second half of the Mishnah. Okay, so that's very good. Most of the Rishonim make it clear here that this is a dinin ktubah, not a dinin mizonot. The rights to mizonot are equal across the board, no matter when your lien starts. Because it's not relevant when the lien is, it's an obligation that the husband has, irrespective of the lien. And therefore, many Rishonim believe that our Mishnah is exclusively speaking about ktubah, and not about mizonot. When it comes to mizonot, they all have equal rights to mizonot. That's whether he's still alive or he's passed away. No matter whose lien is first, that's irrelevant with regards to mizonot. With regards to ketubah, then it will have relevance, and they separate between mizonot and ketubah. Okay, nasata rishona. He married the first woman. Shmami natzlat. From our Mishnah, you would draw three conclusions. Shmami na achat bechayav, v'achat bimoto, yesh lehen tubat benin dichrin. In the case here, the latter case in the Mishnah, in a case where the first woman predeceased the husband, and the second wife survives her husband. In that case, our Mishnah says that the second woman has rights of precedence. She'll get paid out on her ktubah. But in an instance where there's sufficient assets in the estate, then both women will get paid out in terms of ktubat benin dichrin. And that's what the Gemara just concluded here. Shvamina achat bechayav. One woman passed away while he was alive. V'chat memoto. And one woman survived him. Both of them are entitled to ktubat b'din dichrin. Now again, if there's only sufficient property for one of them, then the second one has rights because she's a creditor versus the first one who has no rights. She's just a Tanai Beitin. But in the case where there's sufficient assets, from our Mishnah, it sounds like that they both, Yorshim, would be entitled to their mother's tuba in terms of Ktubat Benin Dichvin. V'lo chayshina lenin tsuye. And we don't worry about the fighting that might come up because of this. The reason they would come to fight over here is because the Yorshim and the second woman are saying, we're coming as creditors. And then in terms of Yerusha, we're getting nothing out of the Yerusha because you guys are getting everything for your Ktubat Benin Dichrin. And that's why we thought they might have had an altercation over here. Despite that fact, we say we don't worry about that issue. Now, the Rabbeinu Chananel notes over here, that's only true when the Yoshea Shniyah are coming. When it's the inheritors of the second woman, that surviving wife also passed away. But if the surviving wife comes and she collects her ktubah for herself, and then we would entitle the first group to take their ktubah b'nin dichrin, then the inheritors of the second wife will get zero. Ktubah goes to their mother, and the Yerusha is going to the other brothers who are the children of the first woman, and they get absolutely nothing. In that case, atel yitzuye. We would worry about them fighting, and we would not allow the ktubah b'nin dichrin to go through. Therefore, they say that this case is only relevant when the surviving wife also passes away, and they get her ktubah. As creditors, the second group gets their ktubah, but they get something. But in the case where she's still alive, they'll get absolutely nothing, and then, atel yitzuye, there will be a fight about this. Mimai. How do you conclude that from our Mishnah? Midiktani, shniya v'yorsheh kodmim l'yorsheh rishona. The second wife and her inheritors go before the first one. Miktam hu d'mekadme. That is that they get precedence. Haika shakle. But if there is enough in the estate for both of them, both parties would collect what belongs to them. That means ktubat benin dichrin would be in effect, even though one is coming as a survivor of her husband and one predeceased her husband. Rishmamina. The second conclusion you would have from our Mishnah is, ktubah nasef motar l'charverta. One ketubah can be considered a leftover for the other ketubah. If you remember earlier in the Masechta, when we talked about ktubat benin dichrin, two wives, each who have a ketubah, that ktubat benin dichrin only goes into effect if we can accomplish nachla d'oraita. So back then we said, if there's a motar dinar, if there's a dinar left over in excess of both ketubot, then each set of children collect their mother's ktubah, and that last dinar will be the Yerusha d'oraita, and they'll split that evenly. So that's only if there's a motar dinar. In our mission over here, seemingly, you do not need the motar dinar. Why? Because the payout of the ktubah to the woman who survived her husband is considered to be Yerusha. And it's their obligation then to pay the indebtedness of their father. She's a creditor, the second wife. So that's what it's saying here. Shema mina ktubah nasin motar l'chavetah mimai. Motar dinar. That the fact that our Mishnah doesn't say you need an excess dinar in order to pay out both ktubot, that is because when they pay out the second woman's ktubah, her ktubah is equivalent of a creditor coming and collecting. So what is that? They inherited. All the children inherited the property. Now, they have an obligation to pay a creditor. That's the second wife. So they pay out the creditor, they pay out the second wife, and now there's nothing left except for the amount of the first ktubah. What we're suggesting our Mishnah is, then we would pay out the first set of Yorshim, their ktubah, even though now the second will get nothing. I mean, their mother got their ktubah, but the second Yorshim will get absolutely nothing. Nevertheless, we'll say it's good, because that first payout was a payout to a creditor, and that's considered to be Yerusha. Shema mina, the third thing is, ktubat binin dichrin no tarfa mimishabde. That a ktubat binin dichrin doesn't have a right to grab from encumbered property. How do you know that? Because if they were able to grab it out from encumbered property, Yerushima, the second woman, they will collect based as creditors. So they'll get the money. Then, what the first woman's children will say, we're owed the ktubat benin dichrin, and we're allowed to take from encumbered property. You know where that encumbered property is? It's right now with the second set of children. We'll grab it back and take it. The fact that they're not entitled to do that shows you that ktubat benin dichrin is only an entitlement from free and clear property. It's not an entitlement from encumbered property. So Matifla Ravashi. Ravashi challenges all three of these assumptions that the Gemara came to, these three conclusions that they drew from the Mishnah. Mimai, how do you know that your conclusions are true? Dilma, lo'olam emelecha, achat b'chayav, achat b'moto. If one of the wives predeceases him and the other one survives him, ein lahem ktubat benin dichrin. There is no ktubat benin dichrin. My kodmin. So what is the word kodmin over here? The nachalok tani. It's telling you that the second group have a kedima in nachala in terms of the inheritance. Nothing to do with Ketubah B'nei Nichren. There they have the first right of collection in the Yerusha because their mother is a creditor. So they go first. If there's anything left over, they're going to split it equally. Who says after that you're going to give it to the Ketubah B'nei Nichren? B'chitema Yorshei Rishona Lomali. If you're going to say to me, then why mention the Yorshei Rishona at all? I did the Tana Shnia V'Yorshei. Tani Nami Yorshei HaRishona. That's because at the end, when it talks about the Yorshei Shnia, that's because they have real entitlement as creditors. So it mentions the Yorshei Rishona, not because they're entitled to their Ketubat B'nin Dichrin, but simply because, again, parallel structure in the Mishnah, which says that really, or Yorshei Rishona are no different than the Yorshei Shnia. They're all equal in terms of the Yerusha. Why did you mention them? Just because you mentioned Yorshei Shnia, we also mentioned Yorshei Rishona, but not to tell you that they have any more rights than the Yorshei Shnia. Vitika Amar. And the second conclusion that you drew, Ketubah Naseid Motar Lechaverta, that one Ketubah is deemed to be a leftover enough to collect B'dinin Dichrin from the first Ketubah, Dilma Lo Omer Lecha, Ain't Ketubah Naseid Motar Lechaverta. Maybe I'll tell you that's not true. V'halcho Udika Motar Dinar. Because maybe in our mission there was an extra dinar left over, there was an excess of both Ketubot. Who says that's not the case in our Mishnah? You thought it wasn't. But the Mishnah doesn't say that. Maybe there was a motar dinar. V'chad b'chaya, v'chad moto, t'nayehi. And this idea of one that predeceases him and one wife that survives him, by the way, that's a machloket tanaim anyway. T'tanya, meitu, achat b'chayav, v'chad b'moto. In a case like our Mishnah, where one of his wives predeceases him and one of them survives him, that the children of the first wife can say to the children of the second wife, Bnei balat chovatem, tlu ktubatimchem vitzu. You guys are creditors. Take your mother's ktubah, your loan, in a sense, your entitlement, and get out of here. Rabbi Kiva Omer, kvar kafza nachla mifnei bnei arishona, v'nafla v'nei bnei shniya. Rabbi Kiva says, no, that the nachla already moved from the first to the second. My love, v'haka miflige. Sounds like this is what the argument between Ben Anas and Rabbi Kiva is. That's Benanas. Benanas is saying to the first children, the Yorshei HaRishona are saying to the Yorshei HaShnia, take your claim, which is you are creditors, take your payout, and then get out of the way, because then we're going to collect our Ketubat Benin Dichrin, and you have no entitlement after that. We have first rights. Once we've cleared out your mother's Ketubah, we have first rights to the Yerusha, we're not going to split it evenly. Umar Savar, on the other hand, Rabbi Kiva says, Echad b'chayav, echad moto, ein lahem ketubah b'nin dichrin. And therefore he says, kvar kafsa. The money already moved from the Rishona to the Shnia, and therefore they only split evenly. After the second group collects their ketubah, their creditor rights here, then they're going to split it evenly, and there's no ketubah b'nin dichrin for the first group. Amar rabo ashkechintu l'rabonon debay rab, diyat v'vikamre. That they were sitting and say, dekulmei alma, everybody agrees, echad b'chayav, echad moto, yesh lahem ketubah b'nin dichrin. Everybody agrees that there is ketubah b'nei nichrin, and that means after we pay out the second wife, or the second wife's inheritors, Yorshim, then the first Yorshim come and they have the first rights of collection on the Yerusha until they clear their ketubah. This is their question is about whether a ketubah is deemed to be left over for another ketubah. I mean, is this considered to be Yerusha d'oraita so that the second group can collect? V'u'adin the balchov. And that would be the same question that you have by a regular balchov kamiflege. That any creditor that comes and makes a collection against the estate, do we deem that to be real Yerusha? And since it's real Yerusha and they paid it out to the creditor, they were jointly owned that property and paid it out to the creditor. That means whatever's left over now gets determined by ketubat b'nin dichrin. And whoever has the first ketubat b'nin dichrin will get paid out first, up to the amount of the ketubah. And the second parties will have no rights over there. Do we say that it's deemed to Yerusha? Mar Savar Ketubah Nasit Motar Lechaverta V'Adin LeBalchov. Benana says that the payout of the first Ketubah is deemed to be full-fledged Yerusha. Same if they paid out any regular creditor, even if it wasn't a second wife. They paid them out. That's deemed to be Yerusha Doraita. And their Yerusha Doraita now obligates them to pay out to the creditor. So they've accomplished Yerusha Doraita. Now, we go by Ketubat B'nin Dichrin. Umar Savar and Rabbi Kiva believes, Ein Ketubah Naseid Motar Lechaverta V'Adin LeBalchov. Any payout to a creditor is not deemed to be Yerusha Doraita. And therefore, we're starting from ground zero. If you're starting from ground zero, there's not sufficient here for both ketubot. That means you're going to split it evenly, and ketubah b'nin dichrin will have no influence whatsoever. V'amina lehu. And so Rabbah says, I said to them, Ana b'balchov kuli amalo pligei davi motar. He says that I disagree, that by Bachov, everybody agrees that it's considered a motar. Ki plige b'ktubah. Where they argue is by the ktubah. That is because there's a big difference here. When it's a creditor coming on the estate to make his collection, all the yorshim are chayav to pay that creditor. That means when you pay out that creditor, that is real Yerusha. He's first in line, but all the yorshim are paying out to him. On the other hand, if it's a ketubah case where it's the second wife, when they pay it out to the yorshim of that woman, that means that somebody got money, but the payout or the obligation was really on the first yorshim. The second yorshim are coming as creditors here, not as yorshim. So he says that you have to be careful. In the case of Baal Chov, where there's an independent third-party creditor, then all of the Yorshim are paying out. That means that they all were Yoresh, and they're paying out. On the other hand, where the second wife survived, her Yorshim are not collecting because they're Yorshim. They're collecting because they are creditors, but not as Yorshim. That means that the Yerusha never really reached them. The Yerusha never reached all the Yorshim, now they're paying it out. It's that there was no Yerusha, because that they cut off the Yerusha in the beginning. So that's what Rabba says. Rabba says there's a difference between a regular creditor and a creditor where the Yorshim are coming as creditors. That's what he's suggesting, that there's a difference between Ketubah and Baal Chov. Everybody would agree by Baal Chov it's a leftover. By Ketubah, that's the machlok between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Nanas. Matzkin for Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef challenges that and says, Ihochi, Rabbi Akiva Omer Kvar Kavtsa Nachala. If that's what you're saying, then Rabbi Akiva's statement, which says that the Nachala moved over already, Im Yesh Motar Dinar Mi Boilei. Then the only question here is there a motar dinar in excess of the first ketubah or not? Their argument is whether there's motar or not motar. El Amar Rav Yosef. So then Rav Yosef disagrees with Rabba's whole setup over here, because otherwise, the only reason Rav Akiva argues over here is because there's no excess. If there was an excess, he would agree that there is a ketubat benin dechwin. So then Rav Akiva's lashon should be not kfar kavtsa, a statement of fact, it should be a statement of if. If there's a motar dinar, then Ben Nanas is right. If there's no motar dinar, then Ben Nanas is wrong. But he doesn't say that. He just says it as a statement of fact. So that's a problem. Halama Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef suggests a different explanation of the machlok between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Nanas, which is, v'chad chayav, v'chad memoto, kamiflege. They are arguing like we thought originally about the issue of one wife who predeceases, one wife who survives. And they're arguing about, in that case, is there an entitlement? Does ketubat b'din dichrin still exist? And this machlok between Rabbi Akiva ben Nanas is similar to another machlok Tanaim that we have, the Tanya. Nasata Rishona Umeita. He marries the first wife and she predeceases him. Nasata Shnina Umeitu. He marries the second wife and she survives him. Bain Banashel Zu Lachar Mita. Children of that second wife come after her death. Vinotlim Ktubat Iman. And they collect their mother's Ktubah. Rishimon Omer. Im Yesh Motar Dinar. If there's excess of a dinar, Elu notnim ktubat iman, ve'elu notnim ktubat iman. Then each one of them is entitled to collect their ktubat iman, that there is a ktubat benin dichrin for the first group. V'im lav, chokim b'shaveh. If not, then the yorshim divide equally. The second group are always going to get their ktubah because they're creditors. So they're going to get paid out their ktubah. What about the first yorshim? Do they get their mother's ktubat benin dichrin? From Rabbi Shimon, it says, yes, if there's a motar dinar, yes, the answer is yes. They will be a ktubat benin dichrin. From the Tana Kama, it makes it sound like, no, that once the second group is paid out, everything else becomes like regular Yerusha, and there's no entitlement of Ketubat Benin Dichrin. My love, this is what they're arguing about. One in his lifetime, one in his death, Yesh Lahen Ketubat Benin Dichrin. There is such a thing as Ketubat Benin Dichrin, which is that Rabbi Shimon believes there is Ketubat Benin Dichrin. Mar Sabar, and that's the position of the Tanakama. Now, you have to be very careful here, because the Girsah that we quoted over here in this bright day is Nasata Rishona Umeita, Nasata Shnina Umeitu, Bain Baneha Shel Zu La'achar Mita. The way that we have it in our bright day, it's ambiguous. The Zu, and that's going to explain the remainder of the Gemara. Rashi, based on that, explains the remainder of the Gemara. Rashi actually changed the Girsah here to read, Bain Baneha Shel Zu La'achar Mita. That's the girsa that Rashi has. Usually Rashi's girsa is what we have in our Gemara. Rashi changed the girsa. Tosafot gets upset at Rashi and says that all the Sfarim before Rashi came along had a different girsa in them. And the girsa that was found in there was a girsa that Bayim Banei Shalzul Achar Mitat Iman. That the original girsa was, these come after the death of their mother. So in that case, it has to be the second group.
Right.
After the death of their mother, they have the right to come and collect. So there's definitely talking about the Shnia, and there's no room to explain that it's the Rishona. Why does that matter? For the next Gemara. The Gemara now is going to attempt different explanations of this Machloket, in which there's a lot of movement over here. So now, Gemara says, no, maybe not. Lo, Tukul Me Alma, everybody agrees in this Machloket. Achad B'chayav, Achad B'moto. Everybody agrees that there is still an existence of Ketubat Ben Nidichrin in that case where one wife predeceases him and one survives him. They're arguing about whether that excess dinar of Yerusha has to come out of real property. The Tanakhama says that it has to be real property. The leftover dinar has to be real property. And Rabbi Shimon says that even from metaltalim, it's sufficient if there's excess Yerusha of a dinar. Can you really say this? Vatznan. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Afilu yesham nechasim she'en lehem achrayut, eino klum at yesham nechasim she'esh lehem achrayut. Rabbi Shimon is explicit in the upcoming Mishnah, lower down on Sadi Aleph Omen Aleph. Rabbi Shimon is clear that only real property suffices as being a motar dinar. So how can you claim here that in Rabbi Shimon Shita, that he's saying that metaltalei work? No, it's clear that he requires real property, and he says, yet shall make tubot dinar. That excess that you need above the tubot of a dinar has to come from real property, not from metaltalei. Halacha b'dinar mimishabdei kamiflegei. Question is that if you have a dinar from encumbered property, what's the story there? Mar sever mibnei chorin in mimishabdei lo. The Tanakhama believes that only if you get it, the excess Yerusha comes out of unencumbered property, then it works, mimishabdei lo, but if it comes out of encumbered property, not. Even if it's in encumbered property, still you're allowed to collect over there. That's still enough to allow you to have the ketubat benin dichrin. Rabbi Shimon says that the chov, the creditor, this group of individuals, these yoshim over here, are creditors to another party. Them being creditors to another party, is that enough to then allow them to grab the Yerusha, to take back from those other individuals and collect the credit? And that credit will suffice then. Whoever the debtor is sold off his property, now they have to go and collect, and they're going to rip it out of someone else's hands. Does that money, is that okay to use as the excess Yerusha? Does that qualify as excess Yerusha? Or do we say no? That excess Yerusha is stuff that's available to us right away at the time of the death of the father. If it's not there and they're going to later collect it when they go out and collect all their father's loans, then maybe that's not considered to be excess Yerusha. That's the way the Rashash explains it, although other Rishonim explain it in a case where the property is mishubad to a creditor. He's a debtor, and this property is going to leave their hands at some point. Is that sufficient to create the motar dinar, which they will inherit and then pay out to this creditor? Is that sufficient to be considered a motar dinar? Omar says, if that's the case, ihochi, Rabbi Shimon Omer, im yesham motar dinar. Wait, Rabbi Shimon says, if there is a motar dinar. It's not if there is. Kevan sheyesha motar dinar mi ba'ile. Not because if, but since there is a motar dinar. If they're arguing about the fact as to whether encumbered property, meaning that they're an outstanding creditor to another party, whether that's considered to be a motar dinar or not, then their machloket is simply about is it or is it not. So therefore, Rabbi Shimon's lashon should be, since it is considered to be a motar dinar, they collect. It shouldn't be if. It's not about if. They don't have to have if there's a motar dinar. We know there's a motar dinar over here. It's not if, it's since. So the language is wrong. Ela bipachot mi dinar kamiflege. They're arguing about less than a dinar. Must have a dinar in, pachot mi dinar lo. That you have to have a dinar. Less than that's no good. That's the Tanakhama. Masarvar afilu pachot mi dinar. And Rabbi Shimon believes even less than a dinar. Va Rabbi Shimon dinar kamar. He says, wait a minute, he says explicitly a dinar. How can you claim that it's less than a dinar? Which is obviously a very difficult explanation, given the fact that it mentions a dinar in the statement of the Braita, as well as the fact that we always require a dinar. Tosafot even raises other language issues, of course, in Rabbi Shimon's statement of if rather than since. And the only thing you could probably answer here is that we're talking about karka, talking about land, and since land doesn't have a defined value, maybe the land was at one point worth a dinar, but maybe now it's worth less than a dinar. And since it's a fluctuating value, maybe that's what the Gemara is suggesting over here. Let's flip their positions. The Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon, we have their positions backwards in the Braita. Let's flip their positions. That doesn't work. Tanakama de Madnita, Namini Dinakamar. The Tanakama of the next Mishnah also says a dinar, and we said here that the Tanakama of the Brayta and the Tanakama of the Mishnah are the same Tanakama. If he requires a dinar in the Mishnah upcoming, he also requires a dinar in the Brayta. Ella, Kihanach Tre Lishnei Kamai. The answer is, like the first two attempts of Lishonot that we said, Ve'epuch, and flip their positions. So now, according to Rashi, that means the first two answers that we gave, which is either dinar mi karka or dinar mi mishabde, that it has to be a dinar out of real property, or a dinar out of encumbered property, that's what they're arguing about. But we said in those cases that that cannot be the position of Rabbi Shimon. In the first case, because Rabbi Shimon explicitly says you need real property. In the second case, Rabbi Shimon says if, instead of since. So what the Gemara says now is epoch, flip their positions. Flip the position of the Tanakama and Rabbi Shimon. Therefore, Rabbi Shimon requires real property. Like in the upcoming Mishnah, he requires real property. Now he will require real property and the Brayta as well. Or in the second instance where we said, Mimishabde, that it was encumbered property, that the Lashon of Rabbi Shimon was wrong, the Im, the if was wrong. Over there again, we'll flip their positions and we'll say if. If there's a motar dinar that's from free and clear, that's what Rabbi Shimon is saying, then you have Iktubat bin Indichrin. And the Tanakhama says, no, in any case you have Tubat bin Indichrin. And again, we're going to flip their positions. Now, how can you flip their positions? That's not a problem for Rashi because of what we spoke about before, the Girsa in the Brayta. In the Girsa of the Brayta, it says, Ba'im b'nei shel zu l'achar mita. The children of this one come after her death. Which zoo are they talking about? It's an ambiguous term, zoo. It's a dangling modifier. And that's what Rashi says, helps us out over here. Until now, we thought that it was referencing the children of the second wife. When she dies, then they come along and make their claim. So now, when the Gemara says epoch, Gemara's not actually changing their position. It's just saying that banei shel zoo does not mean banei shel shnia, but means banei shel rishona. Means the children of the first wife. And therefore, the Zo over there, instead of being interpreted as Shniyah, we've been interpreted as Rishona. And now the Tanakam will have the position that there is a Ketubah bin Indichrin, because he's saying that the children of the first wife come with a claim on the Ketubah. Along comes Rabbi Shimon to argue on that. And he's arguing on that position with regards to the Rishona. So according to Rashi, Rabbi Shimon now is the Chumrah in the second half. And that's why he can use the Lashon of if, because he's the Chumrah. Or his Shita now matches up, because he's saying no. That a leftovers of metalton is not enough. You need a full motar dinar of mekarke from real property that is free and clear. And that's what Rabbi Shimon is arguing on in terms of the Brayta. Tosafot, as we mentioned before, takes issue with Rashi because all the Sfarim have a different girsa than Rashi, which is that the Brayta says, Bayim b'nei shel zu lachar mitat iman. After their mother passes away, meaning the wife that survived over here, after she passes away, her yorshim come. And that's clearly talking about the second yorshim. So when you say epoch, you cannot flip it and say that it's talking about the first wife's children. It has to be talking about the second wife's children because the language does not sustain that explanation. So Tosva disagrees. V'kasha b'chos frame garsinan lei v'od. Y'abnei rishon akai malo lazkir l'achar mita. And if it's talking about the first children as well, why do you have to talk about after her death? Of course she's dead. We already said in the first part of the Brayta that she's dead. So why do you have to tell me about the Achar Mita? And in addition to that, he says, we could also ask, why can't you sit up there machloket about Ketubat Nasei Motar L'Achar Ferita? That could also be the machloket if you're already saying something about the first children. Alkein Perish Rabbeinu Tam Abnei Shniakai Le'olam. The Brayta is always talking about the second children. Ve'epuch Svartayu. Flip their positions. Which is the diuk that we made out of the Brayta. Before we assume when the Tanakama said that the Bnei Shniyah get it, that means the Bnei Shniyah exclusively get it, and the Bnei Rishonah get nothing. No matter what is in the estate, the Bnei Rishonah are not entitled. That's what we were medayik out of the Brayta. Don't make that diuk, but make the diuk this way. Bnei Shniyah get, and not Bnei Rishonah, that's when there's no excess. But if there is excess, then even the Bnei Rishonah would get it. And that's what it means, flip their positions. And then Rabbi Shimon comes along to say, Dafka, if there's a motar dinar, only if there's a leftover dinar of real property that is free and clear, will that be sufficient? Implying that the Tanakhama says even in cases where it's not free and clear, or it's not real property, that he would say that that's sufficient in terms of the excess. And therefore what Mario says, Epoch, it means epoch, the diuk that you made out of the Tanakama's position, which then determined what Rabbi Shimon's position was. In the first case, you said the Tanakh Kama says bnei shniyah get, bnei rishonah never get ketubah b'nin dechren. And Rabbi Shimon argues and says that they do get ketubah b'nin dechren. Gemara says no epoch. Flip it around and say this. Tanakh Kama says the second get when there's no excess. But if there is excess, then even the bnei rishonah would get. Ah, now that the bnei rishonah get, when Rabbi Shimon argues, he's arguing that the bnei rishonah should not get. And that's how we would suggest that Rabbi Shimon's saying that they do not get ketubah b'nin dechren in these instances when there isn't a motar dinar that is either from real property or from free and clear property. Okay, we're going to stop over here. 15 lines down on Sadi Aleph, Amud Aleph.